Well, hey there. How are you? Welcome to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett, sitting in for the intrepid, indefatigable George Norrie. They won't tell me where George is tonight. I guess I don't have the sufficient security clearance. I don't have a need to know. I have to be above cosmic clearance to get that kind of info. However, here we are. Coming to you live from Toronto, where it's about minus 14 degrees Celsius. You add in the wind chill, that makes it about, minus 25. Again, that's Celsius. And let's see now. I'll do a little calculation here. That's about minus 13, or 13 below zero on the Fahrenheit scale. And that's what we Canucks call refreshing. And I find all of you refreshing. So thanks for allowing me into your homes. It's Friday night, heading on into Saturday morning, which of course means open lines on Coast to Coast AM. That means the last 2 hours of the program, you get to ride shotgun and steer this mothership just about any place you want to take it. Incidentally, I've set up a hashtag for tonight's program. If you'd like to take part in the conversation via Twitter, you can. It's easy. Just hashtag Richard C2CAM. Of course, the C and then the number 2 and the C, Coast to Coast AM. Richard C2CAM. Hashtag Richard C2CAM. All right. I know all of our thoughts and prayers are with the victims and their families after this sickening of violence in and around Paris, France, the last couple of days. And in the face of this horrible tragedy, many of us are left feeling what? Helpless and afraid, certainly angry. And there are many reasons to feel angry and to get mad, as Howard Beale implored us to do in Network. I know Network is one of George's favorite movies. We have that in common. I must have seen Network about 100 times, memorized it. And it's as relevant today as it was when it was first released in 1976, maybe even more so. And whenever the world seems like it's coming apart at the seams, and it certainly does these last few days, I'll sit and watch it. It's like I need a dose of Howard Beale. Now, I'm no Peter Finch, but you know the lines. We know the air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat, and we sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. We know things are bad. They're worse than bad. They're crazy. He goes on, I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to riot. I don't want you to write to your congressman. All I know is first you've got to get mad. Well, a lot of us are mad. But then what do you do with that? Where do you go with that? After we get mad, then what? Well, there's a scientist who may have discovered something that's a real game changer, a way to effect positive change, heal the planet, perhaps. It has to do with the power of human intention. And Tara McIsaac is the Beyond Science reporter at the Epoch Times. She's been here on Coast many times. She writes about and investigates unexplained phenomena, life after death, near-death experiences, out-of-body experiences, spirit communication, UFOs, really the A to Z and everything in between in the paranormal, supernatural, unexplained mysteries arenas. And she's here tonight for the first 2 hours to talk about, among other things, the work of Dr. William Tiller, the former chair of Stanford's Material Science and Engineering Department, who was very much part of the mainstream orthodox scientific world, publishing scientific papers in peer-reviewed journals. Then he gave it up after he discovered, or developed rather, a nagging urge to study what he called crazy-seeming kind of stuff. Let me just crib here from Tara's article in the Epoch Times to set the scene. Tiller was intrigued by the experiments on human psychic abilities conducted by Soviet scientists. He knew his colleagues found the topic preposterous, yet he asked himself, how might the universe be constructed to allow this crazy-seeming kind of stuff to naturally coexist with the orthodox science I'm doing at Stanford with my PhD students every day? He lightened his workload at Stanford in order to make time for independent research to answer this important question. His colleagues staged an intervention to try and stop him from doing this. What Tiller discovered, however, and even the way he discovered it, could spur a Copernican scale paradigm shift. Dr. Tiller had developed a machine that could hold and dispense human intention. Now, there have been a number of large-scale experiments studying and testing the power of human intention, that ability of human consciousness to affect matter, the molecular structure of water, for example, the pH level of water, which on the surface seems like pretty mundane stuff. Tiller's been involved in experiments where human intention has been shown to significantly change the something called ATP production in fruit fly larvae and thus enable them to mature more quickly. But wait, it gets better. Now Tiller has created a machine, an intention host device, where test subjects can direct their intention to this device, and that device can later emit this intention, having the same effect without the person being present. It holds and dispenses intention. And wait till you hear what he's doing with it, or what his intention host device is doing. Never mind changing pH levels in water or the ATP production in fruit fly larvae. And Tara McIsaac will be here to tell us. But this discussion about Tiller and his intention host device will take us into another fascinating realm, because as we'll learn, Tiller's development of this remarkable device was spawned by a fateful, hard-to-believe coincidence. And McIsaac will talk to us about coincidences and some new and exciting scientific studies into coincidence. Can coincidence be explained by probability? Are they miracles? Are they signs? Glitches in the matrix? Coincidences and the incredible power of human attention, coming up next with Tara McIsaac. So I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell. I'm listening to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast AM. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie. Tara McIsaac is a Beyond Science reporter. She explores the new frontiers of science, delving into ideas that could help uncover the mysteries of our wondrous world. Tara McIsaac, welcome once again to Coast. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. Let's talk about the power of intention. And before we get into Dr. William Tiller's device, perhaps a definition is in order. What do we mean by the power of intention, human intention?
Yeah, so basically William Tiller realized that within an atom, you know, you've got, for example, in a hydrogen atom, you've got an electron and a proton, and between all of this is just empty vacuum space. But he realized that this empty vacuum space isn't actually empty. There's a really, really powerful substance there that we can't detect with our normal methods of measurement. And the way he's been able to detect it is basically he's found that human intention somehow affects this unknown substance in such a way that it begins to interact with the substances that we usually see that we can measure. You know what I mean? So he's been able to detect it this way, and that's, you know, basically within this vacuum space, this kind of unseen substance there that can interact with our normal substances that we see when activated, so to speak, with human intention. That stuff there is so powerful. He compared the power there to everything within 15 billion light years of our Earth. You know, all of the energy within, all the electromagnetic energy within that space can be contained in a single atom, and our human consciousness, our intention, is able to affect that substance.
Well, take me back to some of the earlier experiments, and I mentioned them off the top, these experiments where the human intention was able to change the pH level of water. Give me a sort of a mental picture of how such an experiment would have been conducted.
Well, basically, you'd have the water, and then you'd have people directing their intention, you know, deciding, I guess there might have been some sort of benchmark, you want to change the pH level by this much. And without adding anything to the water, just directing your thoughts at it that you want it to change, the pH level would change. And they obviously had, you know, control experiments where the, you know, the thoughts were not directed at the water in the same area. So that's, you know, one example. Then you mentioned briefly as well, but for example, fruit flies with the larvae, they, again, sort of directed their intention at the larvae to change the levels of a certain coenzyme, which would make them mature quicker. So they, you know, they grew quicker than they would have otherwise. And this is just from people thinking at them, basically.
And can this be done, or was this done, these experiments, at a distance, or were the participants, the subjects in the experiment, in close proximity to the water or the fruit fly larvae?
They've done both, in close proximity and far. And actually, yeah, one of the perplexing things for them still, and I don't think that Dr. Tiller, you know, they're still studying it and figuring out why, but it can happen over vast distances. They've done some of these experiments, you know, over thousands of miles, and it still works. And just directing your intention at a subject that far away, it doesn't matter how close you are.
And was it these experiments and the results of these human intention experiments that caused Dr. Tiller to essentially resign his chair of material sciences at Stanford and take up this study full time?
Well, actually, he got rid of a lot of his responsibilities at Stanford, you know, chairing, you know, certain committees and a lot of that kind of work. And so he was actually doing both at the same time. He continued his conventional work at Stanford, but he freed up a lot of his time to be able to independently research a lot of this kind of thing. And he founded the Tiller Institute. And he's brought on some other scientists there who are all working on this together. And I mean, now he's a professor emeritus. He's older, I guess. He doesn't have the same responsibilities at Stanford, but he actually did it simultaneously.
And when he announced that he wanted to pursue the study of what he called this crazy seeming kind of stuff, his PhD students and maybe some of his colleagues actually staged an intervention to try and stop him from doing this. Is that correct?
Yeah. I asked him about the reactions, obviously, of his colleagues. And, you know, that's something I ask a lot of scientists just to see how people react to it. And I found it interesting that he used the word, you know, that they basically staged an intervention. They really wanted to, you know, say, hey, you know, maybe this isn't a good career move and that kind of thing. People are going to think you're crazy or... But, I mean, he already had tenure, he was okay, but certainly maybe if he directed all that towards conventional science, he could have, you know, excelled greatly, even more in the conventional science world, but he decided that this was really, really important, and whatever the consequences, it was something he felt is really important for humanity. I mean, you know, he described, for example, the power of intention this way. It was a really powerful metaphor for me when he used it. He said that 100-watt light bulb, the photons coming off of that, the reason it's not that bright is because those photons are bumping into each other and interfering with each other. But if they could all be directed in the same direction, it would be as powerful as the sun. So he uses that metaphor for human intention. It's like if we can learn the power of human intention, and all of us can direct our attention the same way, we could increase our power so much when we're not, you know, bouncing off each other with all of our conflicting intentions. Once we really understand the power of that, it can really be important to humankind. That's how he feels.
Getting back to these seemingly mundane-sounding experiments, although when you think about it, changing the pH level in water, with the power of human intention, it's incredible. But I'm thinking of that long-standing challenge that skeptic the amazing Randy has held out. You know, the promise of a $1 million that would be paid to anyone who could essentially prove you know, the existence of some paranormal activity. And I'm wondering, wouldn't this qualify? I mean, couldn't Dr. Tiller cash in on the Amazing Randy's challenge? Hasn't he proven paranormal activity?
I would say so. I should suggest to him that he follow up with Randy and see, you know, if Randy's convinced. I haven't read any, I haven't encountered, and I usually look for, you know, the skeptic side of things and to see what other people have said about these studies that I look at. And I didn't encounter any skeptics of these studies. I don't know if there are objections. I couldn't find any. It seems pretty straightforward to me. So I don't know if Randy would be convinced, but I should suggest that to Tiller and see if he would be considered the one to meet that challenge.
And these power of intention experiments, have they been peer-reviewed? Have they been written up in scientific journals in the Orthodox scientific community?
Not in the Orthodox journals. You know, in some of those journals that have been established by sort of like-minded scientists, they have been peer-reviewed. But these haven't been in, you know, the American Journal of or Nature or anything like that. It's been in, I can't remember exactly the journal, but it's peer-reviewed, but it's not in one of the great mainstream journals.
Has he tried? Has he approached the mainstream journals and been turned down? Is that what happened?
I believe so.
Obviously, I mean, a lot at stake here.
I'm not 100% positive, but...
Right. But one could see how such an experiment and the findings of these experiments could be seriously disruptive to mainstream science and why they would be very hesitant. In fact, might even throw up obstacles into getting something like this published in a mainstream peer-reviewed journal.
Yeah, and I mean, so much of it's just not understood, and it's so out of the normal framework. I mean, even with his intention host device, which you mentioned briefly, and I'm sure we'll talk about a bit more, I mean, he said that he could show it to an engineer or somebody who understands conventional electronics, and they wouldn't understand how it works. I mean, it's all kind of perplexing. He understands, you know, what this unknown substance is because he can see it affect these substances that we do know, but there's a lot that he still doesn't know specifically about what it is, you know?
And these experiments are repeatable.
Yeah, he's replicated it, and his research team, they've tried it over the years in different forms, different labs all over the world, different places, different kinds of tests, and they've been able to replicate their results.
So there is no question. It is beyond reproach to suggest otherwise. It is a scientifically proven fact. Can we say this? It is a scientifically proven fact that human intention, the power of human intention, can affect these unseen subtle energies in the universe and produce certain effects, like changing the pH level in water, or, well, we'll discuss what else can be done. But this is, as I say, this is a proven scientific fact, full stop, correct?
I guess that if you talked to a skeptical mainstream scientist, the objection would be that somebody besides the Tiller Institute would have to replicate this for it to be valid. That means, you know, for a mainstream scientist to be interested enough to put the time into replicating these studies, which I'm not aware that that's happened. So, you know, it's Dr. Tiller's been able to replicate it. He's obviously a capable scientist. He's, you know, had a renowned career at Stanford, published many conventional studies that have been peer-reviewed in conventional journals. But, you know, I guess to say that it's 100% scientifically proven, I guess, you know, some would say that maybe other scientists need to do it as well.
And one of the things that you write in your article in the Epoch Times, you say, what Tiller discovered, however, and even the way he discovered it, could spur a, and I quote, a Copernican scale paradigm shift, a Copernican scale paradigm shift. What do you mean by that specifically?
Well, Copernican scale was just to to emphasize that this could really turn everything on its head, completely change the paradigm if mainstream science does accept this and take a good look at it and really try to replicate it. It really is that fundamental, even in terms of, like I said, his process, the way he arrived at some of these realizations. He would meditate for an hour daily and think to himself before he started his meditation.
All right, let me just jump in here. Tara, excuse me, we'll take a time out. We'll come back and we'll discuss this Copernican scale, a paradigm shift, Dr. William Tiller's intention device, as Cat Stevens takes us into the break with The Wind here on Coast to Coast AM. Hey, welcome back to Coast. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie on a Friday night into Saturday morning, and I'll be back tomorrow night, Saturday, with author-researcher Steve Quayle. We'll talk about the missing gold. Is there any gold left in Fort Knox? I don't know. I don't think so. If so, why didn't they allow the Germans to repatriate their gold? We'll get into all of that with Steve Quayle. And we'll also speak with John Lofty Wiseman about his SAS Survival Handbook. This will be a good one. He'll join me in the first hour. I've been reading the Survival Handbook, and I can now say with confidence I can make a snare, I can field dress and gut a large moose, and I can make a two-way radio out of chicken wire and dentine chewing gum. Maybe a slight exaggeration. We'll get back to our conversation with Tara McIsaac, the Beyond Science reporter at the Epoch Times, and we'll discuss the remarkable, almost unbelievable power of human intention right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Richard Serrett sitting in for George Norrie. Got this email from Ken who writes, "Hey, Richard, I took your advice and yelled out the window. I'm listening to Coast. The neighbors called the cops." But seriously, he says, why doesn't Dr. Tiller use his intention machine to propagate the intention of his intention machine? You think maybe it would turn it into a perpetual intention machine? I like that. We can get into that a little bit later with Tara McIsaac, who joins us from the Epoch Times, where she writes the Beyond Science column. Now, Dr. Tiller, not only did he conduct these power of intention experiments, but he took it one step further. And now he's developed this machine, this device, which I guess can record human intention and then retransmit that human intention, having the same effect without the humans. Is that essentially it in a nutshell, Tara? Did we lose Tara? Oh, we lost Tara. All right, while we try and get her back, let me just remind you, if you want to join the conversation via Twitter, would love to hear from you. All you need to do is hashtag Richard C2CAM. Hashtag Richard C as in Coast, the number 2, C as in Coast, AM. Hashtag Richard C2CAM. Tara McIsaac will be with us in just a moment, and we are talking about the human intention experiments with Dr. William Tiller of Stanford University, where he had a pretty good gig going as the chair of the material science department, and then decided to sort of chuck the whole thing to study and dedicate his life to studying what a lot of mainstream scientists have poo-pooed for many years, and that is, I guess, sort of the field of parapsychology, and specifically the power of human intention, human consciousness, and its ability to manipulate matter, if you will. Tara McIsaac is back. Let's talk about this device that Dr. Tiller created, this human intention device. And just before we lost you, Tara, I was trying to describe it as best I could in layman's terms. But as I understand it, this device is a receiver. It will record human intention and then transmit that human intention and have the same effect without the humans being present. Is that it in a nutshell?
Yes, exactly.
What does it look like? What does it look like, Tara?
I'm not sure. I haven't seen it, and he doesn't have photos of it up, but he's basically described, that's the thing, it's kind of a mystery. You know, I asked him how it works and why exactly he picked this device of all devices to do this. I mean, to tell me more about it. The thing is, it's just kind of a generic, this device that he was using for some of his other research, conventional research. And on a whim, he just kind of decided to see if it would hold human intention. And lo and behold, it did have that effect. You know, he used it with the pH level on water, for example. He directed intention towards the machine, and then he used that machine to direct the intention towards the water, and it worked. But the thing is, this machine, it's for some reason it works, but he doesn't know exactly how it works. He just knows it does work. And the coincidence with this machine, too, is, you know, he was using this machine for his conventional studies. And after he did this, he realized that actually the manufacturer had given him the wrong machine. So it wasn't the one he was supposed to be using for that study. And when he got the right machine, it turns out the right machine didn't work as an intention host device. It wouldn't hold human intention the way this other one would. And no other device he's tried would either. So it's just this coincidence that he had a manufacturing error, got this device for other studies, decided sort of on a whim to test it out on human intention, and it works. It's a bit of a mystery. And I mean, he's looking at it, and he said, you know, he could show an engineer this device, and they'd have no understanding, no presentment of why this would hold human intention. It just does.
I mean, you haven't seen it, and I'm guessing, you know, that perhaps he's got this device under lock and key. But I mean, does it have moving parts? I mean, do you have any inkling as to, you know, what it might look like? How large is it? Anything?
I actually don't. I believe that he's got some diagrams in his white papers on his website, but I really don't know much about this machine itself. You know, when I asked him about it, basically we just talked about the idea that it's a device, and even describing it or its mechanical workings, I guess, is pointless because it's not, you know, you can't explain it through those workings. He I don't know. It's a mystery device. All I know is that it does somehow hold human intention and dispense human intention.
So again, the subjects, the human test subjects, would gather around, instead of gathering around the glass of water, they would gather around this human intention device. This device then would capture or record their human intention, and then presumably they would leave the room. He would place the device next to the glass of water, turn it on, whatever that means or entails, and then the human intention recorded in that device would have the same effect on the pH level in the water.
Exactly, exactly. And turning it on is just, you know, plugging it in, basically adding electricity to it, and that's how it works. And the device holds this intention, I guess, for a certain period of time. I believe it was like 6 weeks or something like that. And what's interesting is also this intention host device, when it's been used in a certain laboratory for a certain period of time, that laboratory itself becomes charged with that intention. And it seems to affect the results of the experiments that are conducted there.
That's remarkable. Now, he's not just using this for what I call sort of mundane type experiments, although, let's face it, none of this is mundane, but he's taken this one giant leap forward. Instead of affecting the pH level in water, he's now using this to affect change in autistic children. Explain.
Yeah. Basically, he's used it for children with autism and also for people with depression. And found that by directing intention at the autistic children, he's helped them develop their skill sets and improve their condition a little bit. And same with people with depression, that they're better able to come out of it. And he's done the test on 34 autistic children, and he's continuing to do it. And looking ahead, they're going to do some trials, hopefully on post-traumatic stress disorder And who knows what else? I mean, anything. Cancer, who knows where the test will go if it's worked on autistic children. And it's worked, according to his studies and his results, to such a degree that it's basically, about 90-something, 95 to 98% sure that this device is having the effect on helping enhance the skill sets. He's, done controls to see what other changes and everything in the children's lives, and he's fairly certain that it's actually this device that's helping these children.
I'm guessing we're not going to be reading about this in the New York Times, Tara. This is just too disruptive.
Maybe one day.
Well, I mean, thankfully we have you to write about it. What's the difference between the power of human intention and prayer? Is there a difference?
Well, actually, it's funny that you mentioned that, because he has done studies along with Dr. Nisha Manek, who she's a medical doctor. She worked at the Mayo Clinic before joining the Tiller Institute, and they've done studies on Buddhist relics, and these relics have gone on a world tour, and basically Buddhists gather around them and pray. They have prayer sessions around them, and they found that these relics hold that human intention. So exactly, prayer would be, I guess, a type of human intention. So it has the same effect to physically influence things, and it can, if it's directed at something, if it's directed at an object, it can have an effect on that object physically. It can sort of leave its trace on that object.
Except prayers don't always work. I've prayed for things. Sometimes, well, maybe my prayers have been answered, but the answer is no. So there is some difference, obviously, between prayer and human intention, or at least the way it's carried out. How many people are required in a human intention experiment? How many people do you have to have gathered around a glass of water or this human intention device? How many people do you need?
I haven't read a specific number. I felt like it was, one person would probably be enough. I'm not sure if there's a critical mass required. I'd have to look into that more, actually. But it's a good point you make, about prayer. And even with this intention, I mean, obviously, sometimes, I might intend to make $1 million, but even though I have that power of intention, it won't necessarily happen. I guess it's something that needs further investigation. I mean, to what extent does it work? Is it only in certain studies? Is it only in certain cases? I guess those are questions for the future.
Who else is studying the power of human intention? Is it just Dr. Tiller, or are there other scientists, other universities that are looking into this?
I know that, there are a lot of researchers studying, human consciousness and these kinds of things, which you could say are quite related. Even when you look at things like placebo studies and these kinds of things, it sort of relates to the power of the mind to influence the physical reality. So, I guess I can't think offhand of who to mention in that regard, but there are studies. But even on with Tiller, at the Tiller Institute, there are other scientists such as this Nisha Manek, who I've been in touch with as well, who's helping him study this. And really, they're looking at specifically the medical applications. She sent me one of her studies that is really interesting about the placebo effect. And, in conventional science, basically it's been thought that the reason a placebo works is because the person believes it works, and therefore they influence their own body. But sort of to simplify it, it's actually possible that placebo itself takes on, it changes physically and becomes effective because there are all these intentions around it. You know what I mean? So this is actually being used in the medical world in a lot of ways, and even how it affects conventional studies. That's why I say it's a Copernican shift as well, because when you think that human intention has this kind of power to influence experiments, a lot of the conventional experiments that the intention of the scientist carrying them out could have an impact on the results.
Sure. Because that which is being observed is changed by the observer. I guess we've known that for quite some time. Sometimes a particle behaves like a wave, and sometimes a wave behaves like a particle, depending on the observer. I've always thought, you know, when a faith healer rolls into town and they head down to the local TV station and they do their one of their revival meetings or what have you, and ask for donations, and I think if I had that kind of ability, you know, I'd head straight to the cancer ward at a children's hospital. And I wouldn't announce anything. I'd just go, and I would do. Has Dr. Tiller ever taken this human intention device, well, as I say, into, let's say, for example, a cancer ward and in a children's hospital and observed the effect there?
Not that I know of. I do believe that it's sort of in the plans for the future to maybe study the effects on cancer, but I don't think that's something he's done yet.
You mentioned the coincidence, the strange coincidence, in that the device that he originally ordered, eventually it showed up and it didn't work. So the one that he received by mistake, I believe he referred to it as some sort of divine mistake. What's at play with coincidences in this case? I mean, does it have anything to do with what we're talking about in terms of the power of human intention, or is it a separate phenomenon altogether, or are they related?
I think they're related. I've actually been in regular correspondence with Dr. Bernard Beitman at the University of Virginia, who's trying to get started this whole coincidence studies, and he looks at all the different facets of the issue. And, you know, he and I have talked a little bit about this particular coincidence, and also coincidences a lot of the times related to scientific discoveries. You know, even with penicillin, if you look at the history of how that penicillin was discovered, there were so many coincidences and specific things that had to happen. I mean, just briefly, the way it started was the scientist, his runny nose, he had a cold, it dropped into a petri dish, and he made certain observations, and that's how it started. It's just basically what I would say about, you know, coincidence in terms of scientific discovery this way. It's a combination of elements. You could view it, as Dr. Tiller did, as sort of a divine mistake. Sometimes it really seems that way. And there is something mysterious about coincidences. That's how it shocks us. That's how we really pay attention to it. But there's also a certain amount of actively looking for something. So, you know, he was already thinking about how to, you know, study human intention and these kinds of things. So it was a combination of effects. If he wasn't looking for it, he wouldn't have found it. And even with coincidences, it can be that way. If you're not the type of person to look for coincidences in your life, you probably won't see them or notice them. But if you're mindful of it, if you're always thinking about coincidences, chances are you'll start to see more of them. So it's actually, as I've been studying, you know, various studies and fields in science, I've come across these sort of strange coincidences in scientific discovery before.
And mainstream scientists would have us believe that coincidence can be explained solely by probability. Is that correct?
Yes. I've looked at that aspect, and it's true for certain coincidences. You know, if you sit next to somebody at a dinner party and that person has the same birthday as you, well, it may seem really remarkable. But if you step back and you look at all of the people who you've sat next to at dinner parties in your whole life, or all of the people who sat next to each other at dinner parties in all of human history, there are so many cases where those two people didn't have the same birthday. So it may be a one in a million chance that the person next to you has the same birthday, but if you look at it in the grander scale, it is actually one in a million. It's actually some of the probabilities, it's not as improbable as you might think. But like Dr. Beitman would argue that probability can't explain everything. You know, you have some of these coincidences where the circumstances just stack up. It's not one single coincidence of having the same birthday. It's, you know, you have the same birthday, the same name, you were born in the same hospital, you have the same friend on the other side of the world. And,
oh, absolutely.
You know,
and as we'll discover, Tara, there are a number of different types of coincidence, synchronicity, serendipity, seriality. We'll get into all of that and continue to discuss coincidence with Tara McIsaac, the Beyond Science reporter at the Epoch Times, right here on Coast to Coast AM.